I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, March 23, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish. Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson. Meslow.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, therefore let's go to the consideration of the minutes from Wednesday, March 22, 2006. They are in the packet. Is there a motion on the minutes? Representative Meslow moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, just a couple of announcements before we begin. First of all, we have 11 items on our calendar this morning, and except for two of them that are at the tail end, my intent that they'll all be moved and laying over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So I would like to get through to calendar this morning. Another item before we start is that relative to House File 3308 or the governor's immigration proposals, the bill that I'm carrying, it's currently in civil law. I understand that there are positive talks going on between members of this committee and others on that bill, and I applaud that. Next Wednesday afternoon, we will be taking that bill up again, and at that time, the process, as the last time you heard it, will be fair, and I just want to point out that we will need any amendments prior by 2 o'clock of the day before, or this coming Tuesday. That's it. Let's proceed with today's calendar. The first item on our agenda is... I'd like to move. See, we have House File 3713, which is a clone of the fire safety bill that we've heard previously, House File 2916. And the chair would like to move that we refer House File 3713 to the Committee on Taxes so they have an opportunity to have the bill and look on it. Any look at it. Any discussion on the chair's motion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Powell here. House File 3299, Radio Board Secondary PSAPs added to the 9/11 system. Representative Powell.
Thank you.
Representative Powell, the chair will move your bill, and it is before us.
Very good. Thank you. Secondary Public Safety Answering Point is a PSAP and an Emergency Medical Services Communication Center that assists primary 911 centers with emergency medical dispatching services. Secondary 911 centers operate and maintain the same 911 equipment as the primary PSAP does, with training and certifications focused on emergency medical services needs. Since there's no legal definition today in law, the Minnesota Ambulance Association approached me to help draft language, given this public safety function a definition. And that basically is what this bill does. And the definition is fairly concise and as simple as it could be. It just basically points out what these centers do. I have with me the president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association, Buck McAlpin, to give a brief statement on this, and also if there's any technical questions, we have a technical expert with us as well.
Thank you. Again, for the record, state your name, and you feel free, please, to be brief. This will be laid over on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, but we will see if there are any questions as well. Sir, give us your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Buck McKelp, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Over the last few years, we've discussed the need to identify secondary PSAPs. The term secondary PSAP just came about because primary PSAPs relay as medical calls, and then at that point, there's a zero response where secondary dispatch centers are able to give pre-arrival instructions waiting for law enforcement and police to respond to the scene. And there's been great success with them. There's five major ones in the state of Minnesota: Alina Medical Transportation, Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial Ambulance, Ridgeview Ambulance, and Mayo Emergency. Those five large companies pretty much do between about 65 and 70% of the 440,000 ambulance runs in Minnesota. And they cover about 37 counties right now in the state with secondary PSAP work. So as this has continued to umbrella and gotten to be quite a large topic, secondary PSAPs, we thought it was time that we identified it in state statute with some discussions we've had in DPS.
Very good. Any questions? The chair, by the way, would point out, Representative Powell, we do seem to have a fiscal note that shows there is zero fiscal.
Yes, sir, that is correct. Zero fiscal cost to the state.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, do you anticipate that there will be any other people, these people that are added, qualified for essential employees?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that question hadn't come up, but I will say that Mr. McAlpin stated, these centers are pretty fairly defined right now. There's not a lot of room for growth in them. They're generally, four of the five are with public, or associated with public hospitals. For instance, North Memorial Medical Center covers about a dozen cities, major regional centers in the state of Minnesota, from one consolidated PSAP in Brooklyn Center. And they also cover some in Wisconsin from this one center. So they've consolidated their PSAPs. All their employees are there. They're all private employees, except for one particular entity, and that would be Hennepin County Medical Center.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, as this progresses and more people talk about it, if you find that there is additional people that would qualify as essential employees, will you let me know, please?
We'll talk about that. That's an interesting question, Mr. Chairman, and one that hadn't come up. Okay. Very good. I'll keep that in mind.
And that's why I was so worried reading this. I'm going to ask.
I'm glad you did, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? If not, is there anyone present in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill? Would you please raise your hand at this time? I see no one. Any additional discussion on this? All right, the chair will lay your bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee member.
Is Representative Zellers or Soderstrom in the audience? I don't see them. Representative Messel, we're going to go to you. House File 3647, DWI Task Force, adjust DWI to include controlled substances. Representative Messel, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, at this time I'm moving that House File 3647 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Okay, Ms. Representative Messel, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, 3647 comes to us from the DWI task force. To my left is Professor Stephen Simon, who is always very helpful in addressing some things that that need to be addressed in our DWI laws. The main focus of House File 3647 is looking at the way we are dealing with driving while under the influence of drugs. It's always pretty straightforward when we talk about driving while under the influence of alcohol. In Minnesota law right now, we also have the crime of driving while under the influence of a controlled substance. But I guess the best way to short-circuit the conversation on this is to say that that applies if someone is determined to be under the influence of something that appears on a specific list of controlled substances in statute. That list has proven to be incomplete, and that's in a couple of different ways. One is that the list, that the group of controlled substances that can affect the ability of someone to drive a motor vehicle is expanding faster than we can keep up in statutes. And the other is that the existing statute does not refer to metabolites of those controlled substances, and so it may be that they are, in fact, still under the influence of that controlled substance, but the metabolite is not contained within our statute. What we've done is broaden this, at least in the situation where we're talking about a gross misdemeanor. And that's sort of our way of wading into this situation and being careful before we have that apply to everybody who's driving while under the influence of a controlled substance. So this bill would provide that if someone has a previous conviction for driving while under the influence within the past 10 years, and they are driving while under the influence of a drug or its metabolite, that would constitute a crime, a gross misdemeanor, just as if it were a driving while under the influence of alcohol charge. The key is to recognize that it then becomes incumbent upon the peace officer to establish the evidence that the person is in fact under the influence of that drug or metabolite. That they have to, that it has to be demonstrated that their ability to operate a motor vehicle was impaired because of ingesting that drug or metabolite. That's already the case with the driving while under the influence of a controlled substance. But you should know that just having a little bit of it in, present in your bloodstream as tested by either a blood or a urine test is not sufficient. The may I have just a moment, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes. Right. The second change in the statute is actually a correction that allows for appropriate sentencing of a felony DWI case. I'm going to let Professor Simon explain how our guidelines actually got out of sync, so that people were, so that judges did not have the authority to sentence as I believe the legislature intended when the felony DWI statute was put in place. And it ties in with a requirement of concurrent versus consecutive sentencing. But I'll have Professor Simon lay that out as well. And at this point, if, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll turn this over to Professor Simon.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Simon. I am on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force. This problem arises because of there's a section in the DWI law, 169A28, which requires consecutive sentences when a DWI defendant is receiving a second conviction and sentence. And this was adopted to make sure that the repeat offenders get the longer sentence. But it's a mandatory consecutive sentence. And that problem worked fine before the adoption of the felony DWI law. The problem is that the sentencing guideline rule said that when a judge imposes a consecutive sentence, regardless of what the offender's true criminal history score is, and the Holmes case is what generated this, his criminal history score was 5 or 6, the sentencing guideline rule says the criminal history score becomes 1 or 0. And even though a person with a 5 or 6 criminal history score, a DWI felony defendant, should go to prison, or it's presumptive prison, his score gets ratcheted down to 1 or 0, and it's presumptive probation. So clearly the person doesn't go to prison. And so the language that we are asking for is mainly to exempt felony DWI sentencing, but only when the judge is going to send the person to prison, executes a felony prison sentence, from the consecutive, the mandatory consecutive sentencing language. And in that case, the judge wouldn't sentence consecutively. The judge could then sentence on the person's true criminal history score, and if that score were high enough, the person could go and should go to prison. So this puts the law into the state of what it was when we adopted the felony DWI law. Nobody saw this subtle interrelationship between the rules and the statute.
Any questions? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, could you just explain again, so I understand this, I'm a little bit slow, but what are metabolites and how are they?
A metabolite, when we take a drug, our body's like a chemical factory, and it literally processes that drug and changes it and eventually gets rid of it. But in terms, in order for our body to use the drug, it has to process it, and it changes it into different chemicals. So metabolite is what happens after we take a drug and our body processes the drug. It's the normal bodily processes. A good example is cocaine, which is a very widely used drug and controlled substance. Cocaine is processed by the body so rapidly that by the time the officer will see signs of impairment, but by the time they get a blood test an hour or two later, the cocaine is metabolized and all that's left in the blood is not the cocaine, but the chemicals that resulted from the body's processing the cocaine. Under current law, that person would be very difficult to convict that person. The AG tells us that they have to rescind revocations when they show up in court, and all they have is proof of when the person took cocaine, but all they have proof from the blood test is the metabolite, the normal bodily chemicals produced when the body processes the cocaine. And that can occur in other drugs too. But cocaine is a good example because it's a widely used controlled substance. Has significant impairment facts.
Representative,
does that help, Representative?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any other ways that these metabolites could get into the bloodstream except directly as a result of processing cocaine, for example? Any other way that those metabolites could be in the drug?
Basically, no.
Okay.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eastland asked both of my questions.
Representative Pilsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does each drug have a different type of metabolite that is produced, or how can you tell the difference between, say, the use of a cocaine or an ibuprofen or a prescription drug from a physician?
We do have Glenn Harden here from the DCA, and he can explain that more fully if you want. But each drug, I believe, has a fairly unique signature because each drug has a unique chemical structure. But Glenn Harden is here to answer that question. Also, the first stage is officer stops somebody and sees signs of impairment. And if the officer sees that there's no alcohol or gives a test and it's a low reading, the officer will then call if he or she is not a drug recognition expert. And we have Don Morose from the State Patrol, who is a drug recognition expert, also here. But they call a drug recognition expert who does a variety of both performance tests and questioning tests. That officer, that DRE, then makes a determination. This person is impaired by a class of a drug, a stimulant, a depressant, a hallucinogen, and that then gives the officer probable cause to request a blood or urine test. So there has to be first a determination, a probable cause determination, that the person is impaired by a class of drugs. And then the BCA does an analysis looking for, they like to get directions what to look for, but they could, in a very serious case, they would scan for everything. But in a DWI controlled or drug case, they like the officer to say, we believe it's a hallucinogen, it's a stimulant, it's a depressant. But again, we have both Glenn Harden from the BCA and Don Morose here to answer more specific questions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question goes is similar to what Representative Hillstrom's. Allergy medicines with ephedrine in it, how would that affect? Would that they show up that's the same drug as in meth, or that it gets used to make meth? Would that show up on these screens and possibly there are other over-the-counter medications that have the warning label on them? You may not use or shouldn't you operate heavy equipment when you use these?
They would show up, but keep in mind they're only going to get that sample where we see it if there's a determination that there's impairment. So if a person takes an allergy medication and there's no impairment, the officer doesn't have legal grounds to request the blood or urine sample. And another thing that we built into this is we're only asking that this apply to repeat offenders. And with all my research with repeat offenders, it is amazing and scary how much time and effort they put into trying to avoid being either caught or convicted for impaired driving. They'll take drugs that are not a controlled substance in one or two drinks of alcohol so that they'll pass the breath test, and the alcohol magnifies the effect of the drug, and they get the high they want, and right now they can't be prosecuted. And there were great concerns when we came to the legislature some years ago because it is a broad term. But when we first came, we asked it to apply to anybody. But now we're saying, let's just focus on the repeat offender. Their behavior is very purposeful. They've been through the system once. They've had their attention called to the dangers of impaired driving.
Is there anyone in the audience who's now present who wants to be heard on this bill? Please raise your hand. There is no one. Representative Meslow? Oh, excuse me. Representative Paymark.
Representative Meslow, doesn't marijuana stay in the body for a longer period of time than other drugs?
Representative Paymar, it does.
Okay.
It does, but there's an exception in the statute for marijuana that excludes marijuana.
In statute or in this bill?
Well, currently there's language. In current statute, it excludes marijuana from controlled substances, from the per se language of the statute. Both.
So marijuana, Mr. Chair, wouldn't be considered a metabolite then?
Marijuana itself is not a metabolite.
Okay.
And if at some point, and I think in a year or two, we will be coming to the legislature seeking to expand it to marijuana, but only if it's the metabolite, marijuana or its metabolite is found in the blood. Marijuana can be found in the urine for a long time, but it's my understanding from the DCA that marijuana only can be found in the blood for an hour or two. We're trying to be careful here not to sweep in people that shouldn't be swept into a criminal justice system.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, good morning, Mr. Simon. But marijuana does have metabolites, doesn't it?
Representative Ellison, yes, it does.
And Mr. Chair, and if the metabolites were found in the blood, then that would meet the threshold of the statute, at least as to that part of the statute. Am I right? You don't understand what I'm saying?
Representative Ellison, yes.
Okay. I guess I'm concerned that we would be criminalizing conduct that doesn't necessarily represent impairment, as I understand the bill, because what would happen is the officer would make a, I guess, on-the-road determination that the person, there was probable cause for impairment, it could be something like weaving. Then if the person was a repeat offender, they'd have a blood test, and then if they were metabolites, if all that could be proved, then they can be guilty, right?
Representative Robinson, no.
Okay.
The officer will see some driving conduct, which would be the cause for the stop.
Right.
They then need to do, if they're not a drug recognition expert, they need to call one, to do literally an evaluation of the person themselves to see person impairment. The driving conduct are not sufficient. They have to see that the person, they have to see signs of impairment in terms of the person's behavior.
Mr. Chair.
And again, it's only limited to, and I apologize, Representative Wilson, we limit it to repeat offenders. And by the way, repeat offenders, another drug that we know they use heavily is marijuana, because they know right now they can do that legally, but drive impaired.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
So, and forgive me, Mr. Simon, I kind of breezed through the bill, didn't get a chance to really look for it. So this only applies to number two and up, is that right?
Representative Ellison, correct. And we were very careful to word it that way, because we know the concerns of the legislature. And
last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, also we were careful so that there can be no license action, no implied license action, if they find a drug, or other than a controlled substance, a drug or its metabolite in the person's blood. The implied consent law has changed to authorize a test request, but there is no license action that can be taken solely, unlike alcohol, solely for the presence of the drug or its metabolite. Only a criminal prosecution.
Representative Easton, you had a closing question.
I just have kind of a comment. It would seem like... First, one thing I'm not sure of, if somebody got picked up for having some kind of a impairment and they had no previous DWI, nothing will happen. Is that what I'm saying?
Representative Easton, that is correct.
Okay. Then if they get picked up a second time, does the first one then count as a DWI?
The first one would have to be a non-drug. It'd have to be an alcohol or controlled substance. The first one would count.
So someone might get picked up for a couple of times if they're taking an over. I'm thinking of grandma. It's taken a lot of us. A lot of us are going to be grandpas and grandpas in the next 10 years. And there's more and more drugs that are out on the marketplace that people are taking that could have, maybe they make you feel a little lightheaded or something and you swerve a little bit on the road. But you've never had a DWI and you're never going to be picked up for that. Could repeated violations of this have the effect of...
Representative Eastland, no.
Okay, that's my question.
Okay, thanks. First one has to be either alcohol or controlled substance.
All right, Representative Meslow, do you have any closing summary?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, if there's nothing further, Chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. And Representative Meslow, stay at the table. We'll take up House File 3540, County Attorney's Blakely Reforms. Representative Meslow, move your bill. This will also be for possible inclusion.
That is again my motion. This bill would be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. This is House File 3540. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 3540 addresses Mr. Blakely, who has become one of the most famous people in criminal law circles since Mr. Miranda. You'll recall that Blakely was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that limited the court's abilities to impose more severe sentences to criminals who were convicted under circumstances that seemed to merit more severe sentences. We took some action on Blakely last year as a part of our omnibus bill, as part of House File 1. Because we were trying to go slowly and be careful, we sunsetted many of those provisions. The county attorney's office and the public defender's office have been working together to look at what we did last year, to look at how we could extend some of those, how we should now remove the sunsets and extend those reforms, do some other little tweaks here and there. And I think rather than go through each of those individually, I will turn this over to Pete Cahill from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, who can discuss that in more detail.
Any questions at this time from the author? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow. So I've been concerned about the date of enactment provisions with regard to Blakely because I'm concerned that there's a category of cases, people whose cases were pending at the time that Blakely came down, who had already been gotten its judicial sentencing enhancement. And then requiring them, and then their sentence would have been then found to be unconstitutional, and then trying them again on the what I would deem to be an enhanced or aggravated form of what they were convicted of originally in front of a jury. Does your bill address those people? You understand what I'm saying?
I believe so, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison. I don't believe there's anything in the bill that would have addressed those cases that were pending at the time that Blakely came down. This is a going forward situation.
Okay.
So that it would not be ex post facto, for example.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, exactly. You understand where I'm going with this. I wonder if Mr. Cahill has any views on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I think some of the more technical fixes do apply to resentencing and sentencing hearings.
Could you touch on that, please, sir?
So that could actually be that the situation you were, I think, describing, that a case that has maybe been sentenced and is being remanded back to the district court for resentencing,
right,
that these provisions would apply to resentencings occurring after that date. In the Shattuck case that started a lot of this, the court specifically said that they weren't making any decision as to whether resentencing or sentencings in that kind of window you're talking about would violate double jeopardy or any other rule, and they essentially invited the district court and I assume Mr. Stewart and the public defenders to bring those up as issues. My understanding is those are being litigated as we speak. We're fairly confident as the County Attorney's Association that it is constitutional because there was a death penalty case that involved a similar situation where a person was sentenced to death. The statute was found to be unconstitutional after that. It was remanded for a resentencing. And even then, they were allowed to seek the death penalty. It was found not to be unconstitutional. It was found not to be a violation of double jeopardy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
So in that case, which I believe was obviously was a Supreme Court case because we don't have the death penalty here.
Right.
But what about the state constitution? Is that implicated on this at all? I mean, if this bill could apply to resentencings, what you're saying is that it would not violate the federal constitution. Could it violate the state constitution? If the state constitution were found, is my question clear?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, okay. Your question is clear. I don't think there's been ever a state constitutional decision on specifically a double jeopardy, resentencing, any type of this issue that would change the standard for the state constitution to make it essentially broader.
Mr. Chair, but the state constitution is actually broader in other areas. For example, under the federal constitution, you don't have to have any suspicion. You can break the dogs out and have them sniff around a stopped vehicle. And under the state constitution, you got to have some basis before you do that. Also, in the Russell case that you know well about, there are other cases where the state constitution, thank God, has protected citizens more than the federal constitution. I am aware that the state constitution has a double jeopardy clause, the ex post facto clause, and it's at least arguable that you have a right to be sentenced by the same jury that heard the original case. Do you have any thoughts about the applicability of the state constitution in light of that? And if you don't, that's fine, but do you?
Mr. Cahill, your views on the state constitution? Go ahead.
As a lowly prosecutor, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ellison, my opinion is that generally, as you're aware, the state constitutional case law that has come out generally finds that the state constitutional provisions are often identical as far as their standards with the federal constitution. The Supreme Court seems to have articulated a standard that it's when the Supreme Court seems to be changing precedent or changing the standards radically that the Minnesota Supreme Court will find our state constitution more broad in order to keep what they see a more consistent view of constitutional rights. As far as this goes, I don't think there's necessarily a consistent body of case law saying that on resentencing it's double jeopardy. I don't think if the Supreme Court were to come out with another opinion on the federal constitution that our Supreme Court would say we've had a sudden deviation and feel that the state constitution would have to step in and then recorrect the course, so to speak. But then again, I don't have a judicial robe, and I'm just one county attorney with an opinion.
Mr. Chair, is the state public defender going to offer an opinion on this? You don't have to, but
we got the horse's mouth here. We can ask it.
All right.
Mr. Stewart, can you help us out? Representative Ellison, restate the question, would you, please?
Mr. Stewart, if we're talking about cases that were pending at the time that the Blakely decision issued, I guess my question is, what is your view on the applicability of the state constitution to what I would argue would be retroactive application of procedures on those cases regarding resentencings?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair.
Your name.
Representative Ellison. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. We had a lot of discussions with the county attorney about effective dates in the course of this bill being put together. Almost all of the sections just apply to crimes committed after August 1st of this year. The assistant state public defender who's done all the Blakely litigation in the Minnesota Supreme Court has reviewed this, and he believes that these effective dates are okay. And honestly, that's all I know about it, that there may be something in litigation now that might affect this whole situation, which we don't know about. But as of yesterday, he thought these effective dates were okay.
Representative Meslow, were we done with any presentation?
We are done with any presentation here at this time, Mr. Chair. Unless there are additional questions, I would renew my motion.
Before we go to additional questions, anyone else in the audience who wants to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. I saw one.
Okay.
At this point, however, any further questions from the committee of this witness? Mr. Stewart, return to the table, please. You've raised your hand. I'd like you to limit your comments to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As has been mentioned, the public defenders had several meetings with the county attorneys, and we worked out agreements about virtually all of this. The one aspect that I would ask the committee respectfully to take a look at as you consider incorporating this is Section 4, which deletes the requirement of a pattern before you enable a court to aggravate a sentence for a person who has had five or more prior felonies. This is also in House File 3506 that you're going to hear later this morning. I would just say about this, Mr. Chair and members, that the sentencing guidelines grid already has an additional penalty for the person that has five or more felonies. The whole system is set up so that the person's prior record is taken into account. It's done automatically. It's done without the need for a jury trial. And it's not clear to me why it would be a good idea to take out that pattern requirement and have departures based on a jury trial for people that have more than five felonies. Virtually all of these people are nonviolent, repeat property offenders. And although it's hard to summon up sympathy for a person who's got five prior felonies, there's an element of this that is sort of piling on if you already have the prior record considered automatically in the presumed sentence on the guidelines than to go and make the departure as well.
Any questions of this witness? Thank you. Representative Meslow, would you care to wrap up at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member.
Mr. Chair, I think everything's pretty well covered. I'll simply renew my motion at this time.
All right. The Chair will lay your bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Soderstrom on House File 3414, Fixed Conflict in Juvenile and Predatory Offender Statutes. And if you'd like to move the bill, then I, at the conclusion, the chair will lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, members, I am Representative Judy Soderstrom. I represent District 8B. House File 3414 is a bill that clarifies the retention of juvenile adjudications of delinquency for registerable offenses to allow compliance with the predatory offender registration statute. Under our Minnesota statutes, the BCA is required to delete adjudications of delinquency when the subject turns age 28, unless they've been convicted of a felony as an adult prior to the deletion. Then the adjudications of delinquency are retained for as long as the adult record is retained. Under our Minnesota statutes, an individual is required to register if they've previously been convicted or adjudicated of a crime against a person. The problem is that if the adjudications are deleted at age 28, they would not be accessible to make the registration determination. So this proposed change would allow for the retention of the juvenile adjudications of delinquency for crimes against a person in order to comply with the registration determination statute. And I have Julie Letourneau, who is from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, here to answer any questions.
Are there any questions of members of the committee of this witness? Is there anyone present in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill? Could you please raise your hand now? There is no one. We'll return it to the committee. Any questions? Representative Soderstrom, the chair will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next bill we're going to be taking up is House File 3197. Representative Smith, should we say you have 2 minutes to testify here?
Well, I don't mean, Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best. Mr. Chairman, House File 3197. I'd like to move the bill, and then when we're done presenting, we'll stand for questions, and then I'd ask that you lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mr. Chairman, in about one sentence, and we do have some folks here from the county, the bill would authorize the 4th Judicial District to extend the duration of the Domestic Fatality Review Team pilot project until December 31 of 08. And then if it is extended, it would require a report in January of 09. So this is a request for an extension of the project.
Okay. Are there others you want to testify, or are you just going to, for questions?
If there's any, Mr. Chairman, if you have questions now, we'll ask them. And if
okay.
there are none, then we'll try to be quite brief.
Any questions from the committee at this point on the bill? Okay, then... your testifiers want to testify then, Mr. Reardon?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I would like the witness to give you about 1 minute or less with a little bit better explanation than maybe I have done.
Okay, Mr. Reardon, would you state your name for the record and make your comments?
Mr. Chair, I'm Tim Reardon. I'm the project director for the Domestic Fatality Review Team. It is a collaboration of private, public, and nonprofit organizations that operate in Hennepin County. With me here is Lana Stevens with the Minnesota Battered Women's Coalition. The purpose of the Domestic Fatality Review Team is to examine deaths resulting from domestic violence in order to identify the circumstances that led to those homicides. Our goal is to prompt improved identification, intervention, and prevention efforts in similar cases. Since our team began in 2000, we have implemented well over 24 substantive programmatic changes that have resulted in better support for victims of domestic violence and increase the penalties for those who perpetrate that kind of violence.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, since she's here, I'd ask Ms. Stevens to simply to identify herself, her group, and the standing of their support on this bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Stevens. Would you identify yourself?
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Smith. My name is Lana Stevens. I work with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We represent at least 110 domestic violence programs throughout the state of Minnesota. And I just wanted to follow up that I am a member of the Hennepin Fatality Review Team. And out of this team, if you'll remember last session, the great piece of policy that Representative Smith authored for strangulation as a felony was actually part of this recommendation from the Hennepin Penn Fatality Review Team, and was backed by Tim Reardon. So we would just like to kind of echo the support for and ask for your support on this issue. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if there aren't any more questions or...
Any more questions from the committee or any questions from the audience? Okay. Does that conclude your comments, Representative Smith?
Just ask if you're laid over.
Okay. In House File 3197. 3197 will lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, if you would take House File 3005 next, I would appreciate it.
Okay, House File 3005, and is there a technical amendment to that, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's a A1 amendment.
An A1 amendment. Okay.
Again, I would move the bill and ask that when we're done, that you would lay it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. I'd like to...
Should we put the amendment on there, sir?
It's your pleasure, yes.
Okay, then we've all seen the A1 amendment, so the motion is to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion passes. The amendment's adopted. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, briefly, this is a technical bill for Hennepin County District Court. The bill allows the Minnesota Department of Corrections to directly reimburse Hennepin County District Court for state-mandated assessments of sex offenders. Current law authorizes reimbursement grants to counties, but not the court, for the assessments. Hennepin County is unique in that court, not county personnel conduct these assessments. This bill enables Hennepin County to avoid the inherent expense delay and inefficiency of obtaining reimbursement through a third party. DOC has no problems with this bill. The Minnesota Judicial Council, which governs the judicial branch, supports the bill. And we're ready for any questions if you have them.
Any questions from the committee? I have one question. How is this handled in other counties, this reimbursement process?
Chairman Mark Thompson, Hennepin County Court Administrator. When we transferred to state funding the trial courts, we did not change this, and essentially what happened was in 86 counties, the assessments are done by county staff or county forensic psychologists that are contracted. In our county, we transferred those staff over with us when we transferred, and this was an oversight on our part.
Okay. Any other questions of the committee? Okay, then... motion is to lay the file over, so we will lay over House File 3005 for future consideration in the omnibus bill. Next on the agenda is House File 3679. Representative Ellison, would you like to take the stand?
Mr. Chair and members,
welcome to the committee, Representative Ellison. Would you?
I will move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Move your bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't you proceed?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very important bill to the operation of Hennepin County District Court. The purpose of the bill is to provide for a distribution of fine revenue that is more consistent with the other 86 counties. Now that district courts are all state funded. To establish consistency with the Hennepin County's formula for distribution of fine revenue for citations handed out without a court appearance. And the third purpose is to avoid costly computer upgrades that would be required to maintain the existing fine distribution system. And now I'd like to introduce testifiers today who will be carrying the water on this and know quite a bit about what's somewhat of a technical subject matter, but very important. And first I want to introduce Mr. Marcus Thompson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Thompson. Would you identify yourself for the record and make your comment?
Mark Thompson, Hennepin County Court Administrator.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This bill essentially corrects an issue that has been longstanding in Hennepin County. In 86 of the counties in the state of Minnesota, the fines are split to municipalities with a percentage going to the general revenue and the other percentage going to the municipality where the offense is charged. In Hennepin County, we have had a system for the last 46 years of, quote, fees taxed, unquote, which means for every count on every complaint, the Hennepin County Court Administrator, myself, gets $5, whether that complaint is dismissed or prosecuted. That system we found with the implementation of the new Minsis automated court system is incompatible. So we drew a line and tried to make this a very revenue-neutral change. I have met with all 48 of the suburbs in Hennepin County as well as the city of Minneapolis, and they are in support of this change.
Representative Ellison?
Well, Mr. Chair, if there are any other questions, I also have two other very knowledgeable testifiers.
Why don't we see if we have questions first, and then we can go from there. Any questions from the committee at this point? Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, if we could just get the estimated fiscal impact on this account where this money goes, the shortages it would make to the other the funds involved here in the distribution. It's kind of a complex schedule where all this fine money goes. I was wondering how it impacts it.
Do we want staff to talk about that? Or is there somebody else that we can... Mr. Thompson.
Representatives, the current program is there's about $9.7 million collected in court fees and fines in Hennepin County for these low-level offenses. Under this program, we would actually be transferring a bit more money to the general revenue fund out of that entire amount. It would be about $87,000.
Representative Cornish?
Well, the Mr. Carter, could you go over where that fine money goes to the different accounts? Aren't we talking about that complex system where it goes half here and half there, and police training and DNR and all this and that?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I think the fine money goes to the general fund. The surcharge money, that's the divided part. It's the surcharge on the fines, and that part of that 1%, I think, goes to the DNR for their funds, of the first $25. It's very complicated, but this is the fine money right now goes to the general fund.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, then thank you, Representative Ellison. We will lay the bill over for future consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Yep. So we'll lay over House File 3679 for future consideration, the omnibus bill. Okay, next we're going to go to Representative Dabney. And this would be House File 1943. And is there an amendment, a DE2 amendment? Representative Dabney, did you want to... does somebody want to move the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair...
Can't move the bill?
The bill is actually not in the committee's
possession.
This is a courtesy of Chair Smith, and I do appreciate that. Hopefully today goes with one or two less hiccups than yesterday did. If I could get the pages assistance, I do have a cheat sheet, or in middle school we refer to it as a study guide. For members reviewing the DE2 amendment. I believe yesterday we reviewed that one of the essential elements of this bill would be to empower Minnesota consumers to place a security freeze on their credit report, that the consumer reporting, the credit reporting agencies would be directed to develop methods over time to get the period of time to thaw a consumer's credit report down to as little as 15 minutes. That's already the case in New Jersey. Members who may be familiar with the Utah law that I believe passed recently also sets that same goal of 15 minutes. The average around the country is about 3 days to allow reporting agencies to thaw a consumer's frozen credit report when they're out searching for credit. But the leading trend seems to be trying to better balance the needs of the consumer for security of their credit report and the needs of the consumer and business for easy access to credit. And that 15 minutes seems to be the leading edge, and I would hope that Minnesota would be able to be part of the leading edge. We also, in the DE2 amendment, there is language allowing the credit reporting agencies to charge a fee, diminutive fee of $5, for placing or removing the freeze, unless the person, the consumer, is a identity theft victim, at which point they would need to have a police report to establish that status. If we move down, the DE2 amendment also includes some language that would help move us along the path we started last year in putting some protections in place for Social Security numbers. We actually did good work as a legislature last year on that, but there's a couple of loopholes left in that area. Specifically, now this language would limit the use of Social Security numbers
to those transactions where it is essential and where no other identifier is sufficient, and particularly when that request is made over the Internet because of issues of Internet security. It also deletes language that was passed last year that limits the responsibility for the current possessors of Social Security numbers and instead brings all users of Social Security numbers up to the same level. Moving on, it creates an opt-in procedure for businesses that would look to sell, lease, loan, trade, rent, or in any other way disclose to non-affiliated third parties personal information that they have on consumers, moving us from an opt-out to an opt-in situation. Prohibits the use of credit reports in the issuance of either insurance or employment, limiting credit reports to the issuance of credit, and then creates a system of consumer-driven credit monitoring, simplifying the process for consumers to know what their credit report contains, who the sources of those credit reports are, and who's accessing their credit reports. Additionally, it assures consumers that the companies with whom they do business have proper procedures in place for protecting and particularly disposing of their personal information. And then lastly, the repealers plug some of the holes that we passed last year when we did good work, good starting work on security breach legislation. We did good work there, but we left a couple of holes, and the repealers here would close those holes. As I stated yesterday, this is part of an ongoing discussion, and I appreciate the chairs allowing me to bring some of that discussion into this room. That's why we're providing the DE2 amendment, even though we recognize the bill is not in the committee's hands. There are conversations going on in the Senate. There's additional conversations going on here. I spoke somewhat at length yesterday with Representative Coles, who's got some similar legislation in some elements, bringing the stakeholders together. And we're hoping that this is a place where we can work bipartisanly this year to do some good things for some Minnesota consumers. With that, Mr. Chair, if there's questions, I'd be glad to stand for them.
Representative Dabney, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we have two bills left, and we're going to go to Representative Zellers, who is on his way in right now. House File 3506, Conformity with Homeland Security Changes. Representative Zellers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The chair is going to move your bill and then lay it over at the end of presentation and questions and so forth for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 3506 is an attempt to allow Minnesota to do a little bit more work that's maybe, I wouldn't say insignificant, but maybe doesn't have the same importance level to the feds when it comes to counterfeiting, when it comes to printing money, when it comes to basic counterfeiting. The Secret Service, unfortunately, they were unable to be here. They will be here this afternoon to testify in the Senate on Senator Rand's committee. So if you have any questions for them, I'll make sure that they either stop by your office. Oh, thank you. Or can have questions asked of you later. But basically, $10,000 are kind of the significant high water marks for them, where they won't and will or will not prosecute on a federal level. They'll kick it down to the states, and they'll ask the state prosecutors to do it, but it's under federal law. What we're attempting to do in this bill, Mr. Chairman and members, is to have the state have that authority so that they can then prosecute at a state level rather than having just a federal authority. There's a number of other changes. I understand the first section we went through with the Hennepin County prosecutor just a little bit ago, and I will tell you that we honestly came at that independently. This is a bill from the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. Commander Abbott and a number of the members on the committee asked us to bring this bill forward on behalf of the Crimes Task Force. We did come to those to that first section independently, so I guess great minds either think alike or have similar interests. Any of the other, and you'll notice in the fourth subsection, subdivision four, the penalties. I know there may or may not be some questions in there for on the levels. Again, this is a first run, and we will be going hopefully into the omnibus bill, and there may be a conference committee. And then the rest is pretty much self-explanatory. We do have some compliance in the last section under subdivision three that brings us into line with the Department of Homeland Security and the Postal Service, who are traditionally the ones that are going to fall into some of the counterfeiting and some of these things.
Any questions? Representative Zellers, I understand you had a witness who is not here yet,
yes.
But are there any questions from the committee? You might have your witness when they show up, maybe hang around if questions develop when we are done, but I see no questions at this point, however. Anyone present in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill, would you raise your hand, please? Okay, if there's no questions, the chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, anyone that has questions, especially Secret Service or Postal Service, will be here this afternoon for Senator Rand's committee. If you have any questions, we'll make sure to have those folks stop by your office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Members, we have one bill left. We're waiting for the author to join us.
Just He does work hard. I don't know that I'd make him do
it. Thanks for joining us.
All right, committee, let's return our attention to the business of the committee. The last bill then today would be House File 3258, Representative Broad, take a seat. Taxpayer-funded abortions, requirement of hospital privileges, report on parental notice. Couple things before we begin. I see you have one witness listed with you. Let me just see who else might be present in the room who may want to testify. Is there anyone present in this room who wishes to testify on this bill? Please raise your hand now. I'm counting one. All right, so Representative Broad, let's maybe plan on you presenting the bill, standing for questions. It would appear we have one witness for, one witness against. We'll try to limit our witness presentations to 10 minutes each and then return it to the committee for discussion, questions, and so forth. So, Representative Broad, the chair moves the bill that it be recommended to pass and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I will be very short with my comments. I think the bill has been heard in a number of committees and will continue to move along. Essentially, the bill has three main portions. One of them is regarding notification in regards to a judicial bypass. The second part of the bill essentially will require that doctors who are providing abortions must have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital at 20 within 20 miles. And then the third portion of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, is essentially a prohibition on the use of taxpayer dollars for the purposes of abortions. And I do have with me Andrea Rao from Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, and she has some remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself, ma'am, then go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak here today. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization of more than 77,000 member families and over 240 chapters across Minnesota. I come before you today to urge you to pass House File 3258, the Abortion Regulation Act. As Representative Roth has explained, the bill is essentially three related pieces of legislation. Each is tied to the others by the fact that the need for them has become apparent due to the annual abortion report published by the Minnesota Department of Health. As evidenced in this report, changes are needed to Minnesota's current abortion law. We have a lack of information relating to a minor's abortions, and in particular, their use of the judicial bypass option. Abortion-related complications are skyrocketing, and the number of taxpayer-funded abortions has gotten out of control. Please allow me to explain a little further. The Minnesota legislature passed a parental notification law in 1981 that was later upheld by the United States Supreme Court. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless her parents are given 48 hours notice, or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion, a process referred to as a judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be mature and capable of giving informed consent, or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, as in cases of abuse. The parental notification data bill would provide a monitoring mechanism for how effectively the bypass portion of the parental notice law is being implemented. The data collected would reveal how strictly the notification procedures are being adhered to, thereby discouraging potential abuse. It would show if certain counties are overburdened with judicial bypass procedures. It would show how the abortion industry is using the mechanism. Policymakers would be able to determine if abortion clinics are making every attempt to involve parents in accordance with the law, or if parents are being circumvented. And most importantly, it would improve the chances that parents are afforded every opportunity to be involved with their minor daughter's decision, or their minor daughter when the abortion decision is being made. 25 years ago, legislators enacted this common sense legislation because they understood the legal rights and responsibilities of parents and the importance of parental involvement in a child's life. The data collected under this portion of the bill will allow policymakers to evaluate the effectiveness of the judicial bypass components of the law. And according to a fascinating article published in New Hampshire's Concord Monitor, there is great need to shed some light on just how this bypass system is working. After interviewing many from within Minnesota's abortion industry, including a representative from Planned Parenthood and the directors of other abortion clinics, those of us outside of the abortion industry were able to get our first peek inside, and this is a sampling of what we found. According to abortion providers, bypasses are, quote, almost never denied. In fact, the director of one of Minneapolis's abortion centers said she has heard of only one bypass being denied in her 8 years at the clinic. According to the article, when a minor calls Midwest Health Center to schedule her abortion, she is asked if she has told her parents. If she has not, the employee tells her of the judicial bypass option and that if she wants the bypass, to allow 6 hours for the abortion and her court visit. Typically, girls are escorted into the confidential hearing by a guardian ad litem. But at Duluth's abortion clinic, the director, quote, doesn't let her clients use the court's guardian ad litems because she feels more comfortable accompanying the girls to court herself. And according to court staff in St. Paul, where the Planned Parenthood abortion clinic is located, the courts are becoming overburdened by the number of bypass requests. This is exactly the kind of information that this bill is seeking. Minnesota has already determined that the state has an interest in trying to involve parents in their minor daughter's abortion. It would only naturally follow that the state has an interest in making sure that this law is working properly. Now, if I may switch gears just a bit and move to the next topic, which is really about protecting women's health. The number of reported complications relating to abortion is up over 40% in just the last 5 years. This is during the same period of time that the number of abortions has decreased by nearly 5%. These complications, which include uterine perforation, hemorrhage, infections requiring hospitalization, and incomplete abortions, vary in severity, but can be serious enough to warrant hospitalization because abortion centers do not provide the needed services. Today, I come before you to urge you to protect these women. Please make certain that they get the medical care that they deserve. We are merely asking that any doctor who performs abortions in Minnesota be required to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. That way, if something does happen to a woman during her abortion that requires care beyond that which can be provided at the abortion center, she can be admitted directly to a hospital and start receiving care immediately. We don't know if Minnesota's abortionists already have admitting privileges. If they do, wonderful. But please pass this provision today to ensure that women in the future can continue to receive appropriate care. If the abortionists don't have admitting privileges, don't you think they should? Don't you think the women of Minnesota deserve that? Finally, I would like to discuss Section 4, which would essentially reinstate a ban on taxpayer-funded abortions. In 1978, Minnesota passed a law that banned taxpayer-funded abortions, except for in cases of reported rape and incest and to save the life of the mother. A lower court ruling in June of 1994 struck down that ban, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe v. Goldman's decision, which established a right to abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, as Roe v. Wade did on the federal level. And it also affirmed the lower court's ruling striking down the funding ban. As a result, today, over 29% of abortions performed in Minnesota are paid for with tax dollars. This amounts to over $1 million per year. From the time of the court decisions in 1994 until the end of 2003, taxpayers spent over $8 million on over 31,000 abortions. Consider that a 2001 Star Tribune poll found that among Minnesota adults, 59% said they personally believe abortion is morally wrong. That means that Minnesota taxpayers, a strong majority who believe that abortion is morally wrong have essentially helped to end the lives of over 31,000 unborn children, a number that grows every day. Some may argue that without public funding of abortion, a poor woman loses the so-called right to an abortion. However, the federal government has disagreed with this notion. In fact, the federal government forbids taxpayer-funded abortions, except for to save the life of a mother and in cases of rape and incest, the same policy that we seek today. The issues that I have discussed, additional reporting related to parental notice, the requirement that abortionists have admitting privileges to ensure the proper care of women, and an end to taxpayer-funded abortions, are reasonable measures which should be supported by pro-life and pro-choice advocates alike. Unless we seek to interfere in the parent-child relationship, are okay with asking women to wait for needed emergency care and wish to force citizens to fund an act which they believe is morally wrong, and to do it at a rate of nearly 10 times every day, we should all be supporting this common-sense legislation that protects and respects our fellow Minnesota citizens. I urge you to support House File 3258, the Abortion Regulation Act, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of the witness at this time. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, Ms. Rowe, could you review again the need for the misdemeanor crime part of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the misdemeanor is in relation to the hospital admitting privileges and is simply some kind of enforcement to ensure that the doctors do have admitting privileges at a hospital.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Robin, you're saying that. So the hospital couldn't say, you cannot come here? Or who's...
Mr. Chairman?
Who is the misdemeanor being levied upon?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it would be on the doctor who would perform an abortion without having the admitting privileges that are required.
Can Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rao, explain admitting privileges to me?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the admitting privileges would be a requirement that the doctor would have to gain before providing an abortion to a woman. He would have to have an agreement with a local hospital that, if necessary, he could admit a patient directly to the hospital.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rao, then, if he did not have this prior agreement, but he admitted a person to the hospital and perform the surgery, then he would be guilty of the misdemeanor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, he wouldn't really be admitting someone. I mean, I don't. The requirement is that before a doctor performs an abortion, he has to have that agreement in place with the hospital in case something does happen during the course of the abortion. Most abortions are not performed at a hospital, and so they're done, you know, at an outside clinic. And so this is to ensure the safety of the women in case something does happen during the course of the abortion. So the penalty would go into effect, or could be, an action could be brought against the doctor if they do perform abortions without having the prior agreement to have admitting privileges.
Mr. Chairman, does this eliminate the hospital from liability then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the hospital has no liability in this.
Anything else? Representative Ellison, then Hillstrom. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your testimony. I believe that I wrote down that you reported that there were 40% complications rate. Did I understand that properly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, it was a 40% increase in the number of complications that were recorded.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what was the...
Ellison.
What was the rate of abortion related complications prior to Roe v. Wade?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I have no idea. I don't think there's probably any way to really determine that number. To my knowledge, it wasn't a reported statistic.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What does the common sense tell you in terms of the safety with which a woman could obtain an abortion prior to Roe v. Wade as opposed to, say, now?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, I guess this bill does not address Roe v. Wade. This bill is addressing essentially the recent increase in complications, and I don't know the relevance of that argument.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're not in court, and I can ask whatever question I want. And so you can either answer it or you can decline to answer it, but I'm just curious to know. Since your testifier made the point that obtaining an abortion at this time has hazards at a rate of 40% increase, what was it before? I think it's a fair question. If you don't want to answer it or if you don't know, that's fine.
Representative Broad, if you care to speculate, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the chances that I would actually be in a court of law are much less than the chances you would, since I am not an attorney. But what we're talking about is an increase over a period of time, and I will turn it over to Ms. Rao, who does have some numbers if you wish to have them.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, like I said previously, I don't have any specific numbers from before Roe. I do have the current Minnesota numbers of complications, if you would be interested in those, but I'm not sure that really gets to what you're trying to ask.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, have there been any deaths or serious injuries reported from abortions recently?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, in Minnesota, I don't know specifically of any deaths, but nationwide, there certainly have been many. There have been a number of deaths related to the abortion drug RU-46, which is being used much more frequently in Minnesota now than it had been previously. There certainly is a risk that is involved that can include death.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
one more. Let's do the following. I want to make sure that the opposition testifier gets the same amount of time. So both, however, witnesses will be here until we are done, so questions can be asked by drawing the witness back. But I want to, within this question and one here, we're going to go to the other witness.
Ma'am, I reviewed the bill and I tried to find the answer to my question. Maybe you could help me. In the report on the judicial bypass, is the identity of the judge one of the things that would be reported or data collected?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, no, that would not. What would be reported is raw numbers. No identities. Identities are of anybody, the minor seeking the abortion, the judges, is not what we are looking for. And, in fact, I think I know some have had concerns that we were trying to get to who the judge is in particular. I think it would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to try to ascertain that information. Any information related to the courts, the most specific that it gets in this bill is according to judicial district, which is quite a large number of judges that you would be trying to determine then. And much of the information is actually just reported on a statewide basis. So I don't think that is a founded concern.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
Just a quick follow-up. We did, in order to address that question of are we getting too close to identities, which is not the intent, we did add an amendment that I just wanted to point out in civil law that changed the reporting from county to judicial district in order to try to address those concerns. It's important to note that the reporting out in terms of the public data is on a statewide basis.
Thank you.
Ms. Rao, Ms. Rao, you will stay until we are done if we return to you for questions. But at this point, Representative Hillstrom, you have one question.
I do, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in this doctor having admitting privileges with a hospital within 20 miles. Do you have a map, maybe, of the state of what areas of the state would not be covered where there is a hospital located within 20 miles of where a doctor might be? Because what I want to make certain is
that in the event this is something that this committee cares about, we want to make certain that if you happen to live in one part of the state, you're discriminated against solely because of your placement. We wouldn't want undue burden. So have you mapped this out, and do you know that there is a hospital within 20 miles of every portion of the state?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, no, I have not actually mapped it out. I do know that, I mean, there are many, many hospitals. I think that it would be reasonable to assume that, you know, hospitals generally are about 40 miles. I don't know specifically. But I can say that for all of the abortion clinics that provide nearly all of the abortions in the state, they all have several hospitals within 20 miles.
It's just one follow-up to that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name. If something does happen at an abortion clinic and something goes wrong, are those patients not admitted to the hospital that's close by?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know. I don't work at an abortion facility. I don't know what their procedures are. I do know that hospitals are required to admit patients when necessary. The reason that we have done this is simply so that the process can be expedited, so that these women can start getting care immediately. They don't have to go to the emergency room. They don't have to be readmitted and go through and answer all of the questions again. The doctor can admit them directly. He has the patient chart available right there. I think it's a time issue as well.
Okay, I'll hold your question there. I want you to stand down and let me have the other witness so we can have some fair and balanced time to both witnesses.
If you have more than one, please come forward. If you're together, that is.
Thank you very much. My name is, for the record, my name is David Schultz, and I'm a professor at Hamline University in the Graduate School of Management, and we have a handout that's being passed around to you so that I can be even briefer and more succinct than I normally am. And again, thank you very much. And just to sort of establish a little bit of my background here, besides teaching at Hamline University, I also teach at the University of Minnesota Law School, and among other things that I teach is state constitutional law, and so that I can talk about some of those issues here. And I want to speak against House File 3258, but I want to put the context of my comments in a different context than what we had perhaps with the earlier speaker and with some of the other people who may be approaching this. And I want to talk about this bill from the context, perhaps, of judicial independence in terms of how I think two provisions especially, and it's going to be provisions for Section 2, Subdivision 5, and Section 4, how I believe that both of those provisions are either A, unconstitutional under either the United States Supreme Court Constitution or are unconstitutional under the Minnesota Constitution. And then secondarily, my argument is going to be, if those provisions, if in fact, are not unconstitutional, they clearly compromise and stand, as I would argue, as an assault upon judicial independence in the state of Minnesota. And again, let me sort of briefly outline my arguments and be very, very brief, and then I can open up for a series of questions. There are two provisions that I'm particularly concerned about in this provision, or in this bill. One of them is the Section 2, Subdivision 5, which would provide for a gathering of statistics by judges regarding the number of bypasses they grant, appointments of guardian ad litem, appointment of counsel, and so forth like that. The other provision is Section 4, which would provide for a cutoff of public funding for abortions provided in the state of Minnesota. First argument is that Section 2, Subdivision 5 is either unconstitutional or assault upon judicial independence. Specifically, I would argue that Section 2, Subdivision 5 violates the United States Constitution in two different ways. First, either under Hodgson versus the state of Minnesota, where the U.S. Supreme Court held that while parental notifications were permissible before a minor could obtain an abortion, they did also say that right to be able to terminate abortions, terminate a pregnancy still existed. And I would argue that if, in fact, Hodgson is still good law, and it is still good law in the United States as far as I know, that
the efforts to try to force disclosure, what they are doing is in many ways trying to intimidate state judges or intimidate judges from exercising this bypass option. And if so, in fact, it may in fact impose an undue burden upon a woman seeking to terminate a pregnancy. Second, I would argue that under Planned Parenthood versus Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, which is still the law of the land in the United States, that the court said that a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy would be evaluated under the undue burden standard. An undue burden exists, and therefore a provision of a law is invalid if its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability. I would again argue that if, in fact, the gathering of statistics is in part aimed at, in my opinion, at trying to make it more difficult for women to terminate a pregnancy, then it would fail the undue burden test. Third, I would argue that Section 2, Subdivision 5, violates the Minnesota Constitution, and it violates the Minnesota Constitution under separation of powers provisions. In cases such as the In Re Marriage of Sandra Lee Holmberg and in the matter of the clerks of the Court of Compensation for Lyons County, the Minnesota Supreme Court has invalidated other provisions that seek to interfere and encroach upon the powers of the judiciary. I would argue that some of the disclosure provisions in Section 2, Subdivision 5, are an encroachment upon judicial prerogatives and therefore may be struck down as unconstitutional. In the alternative, I would argue that if in fact Section 2, Subdivision 5 is not unconstitutional either under federal or state law, that the real purpose of the law is striking at the independence of state courts. I need not remind this committee about the two Minnesota Republican Party versus White decisions in the last couple of years, which may be very well changing the way the courts operate in the state of Minnesota, and to generate a collection of statistics which can be used, even if it's only at the district level, which look at the number of abortions provided, guardian ad litem provided, et cetera, does nothing more than generate a scorecard to be used in the next election against judges. In addition, Section 4, I would also argue, the cutoff of public funds for women wishing to terminate a pregnancy, is unconstitutional. As far as I know, there is no reason to think that Women of Minnesota versus Gomez, the 1995 Supreme Court case, has been overturned. In fact, it is still the law of the state of Minnesota. And essentially what's happening here is that you're being asked to adopt a provision into law that is clearly against state law. Now, why? I don't think you're being asked to do it for the reason that suddenly people are thinking that it's no longer good law. I think the real reason to do it is really twofold. One is that, in fact, either this is just political opportunism, much in the same way as what's going on in South Dakota right now regarding people anticipating a change in the court, or what they're asking this committee and what they're asking the House and what they're asking this legislature to do is to, in fact, fund at taxpayers' expense a test case against the legislature, and in the process to see to fund a case that would eventually perhaps maybe overturn Gomez. I would argue to you that I find it very unusual that a legislature should be in the business of funding somebody else's litigation committee, and more importantly, I find it very unusual that a legislature should be in the business of explicitly adopting laws that they are that they know are probably, or let me rephrase it, that they are adopting laws with the purpose of having somebody invalidate them. And so what I would want to argue as I close up my comments here is that I think the sole purpose of Section 4 is to simply to invite lawsuit challenges as to Gomez. And I also believe that what you wind up doing, as I sort of put in the last page of my handout here, is that what you're doing here in trying to mandate the collection of statistics is to show disrespect for the independence of the courts and to engage in no more in what I would characterize as legislative thuggery upon the courts. Finally, in passing these provisions, you'd be doing no more, as I suggested, than directing the Attorney General to serve as private counsel for a special interest group at taxpayers' expense. Thank you very much. I'd be more than delighted to answer questions.
Okay, we will go to the questions. Did I hear you? I'm going to ask one or two. Can you identify the section in the bill that...
I can't hear you. Could you speak up a
little bit? Can you identify the section of the bill that requires identifying the individual judge?
I stand corrected on that one, because that's why I would... After listening to the previous testimony, I would alter my written handout to say that even if it does not
require individual identification of a judge. I still believe this is no more than an effort to gather scorecard statistics to be used against judges in the next election, and I still believe it has the same intimidating factor upon the courts.
So the answer is it's not in the bill.
It's not in the bill as far as I can tell.
Okay, one other question. I'll just roll it. Actually, two, but I'll roll it into one. In your written handout that you passed out, and I think in your testimony, you are suggesting or accusing the legislature of unethical dereliction of legislative responsibility and duty, and accusing the legislature of thuggery upon the courts. Is that your testimony here today?
That is in part, yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, I resent most of your testimony to start out with, and I'd sure as hell rather pay for a test case than I would an abortion. And the question is, with that high-powered education you had, you should be able to answer. You've probably done some studies on this. We talked about complications before and after the Roe versus Wade. Could you tell me how many innocent children have been killed by abortion before Roe versus Wade compared to after?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Professor Schultz, excuse me.
Sure. I can't give you that number. I don't know.
That's a sad fact.
Any other questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Professor Schultz, I just want to get back to the one of the points that you made is that you believe that the portion of the bill that is requiring some reporting could be used as a scorecard. And that concerns me because I don't see that at all. And I want to make sure I understand where you're coming from. The bill, as I read it, says that, first of all, the reporting is going to be statewide. But even the collection is going to be by judicial district. And I don't know the answer to this question. How many judges are in each judicial district? Does anyone know the answer to that question? Professor Schultz, do you have any idea?
Professor Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'm going to guess off the top of my head that it could be anywhere from like two or three to up to maybe over a dozen. I'm guessing approximately. Someone may have a bit more exact answer than I do, but I don't know have the exact answer off the top of my head.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
My understanding is there's only a few judicial districts in the entire state. That makes no sense.
Yeah. Maybe there's more. I just asked that off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative, on that point.
To that point, Mr. Chair, that there are a total of 10 judicial districts across the state of Minnesota. I think the range of judges that would be in a judicial district would be from the high 20s to the mid 40s.
Okay.
In a judicial district.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. May I add something?
State your name for the...
Connie Kerpich, Senior Legislative Director for Planned Parenthood. And I just wanted to say that although there are just a few district courts that deal with the judicial bypass, I wanted to remind the committee that the judicial bypass process was not in the original bill that the legislature passed on parental notification some almost 30 years ago. And indeed, as a reminder, the state law on parental notification requires clinics such as Planned Parenthood to notify both biological parents, I believe it's 48 hours prior to a procedure. Both biological parents is a fairly high stringent standard, and we are required to make every effort, even if the young woman has not ever met one of her biological parents. And indeed, the vast majority of young women who come to our clinics come with at least one parent. Just want to put this isn't the jurisdiction of this committee, but I want to point out that if the legislature truly wanted to make this legislation to further the parent-child communication, taking a look at this old, very rigid, two biological parent standard is not realistic in many family situations, and certainly would be better and have less bypass procedures with the district judges, because many mothers are accompanying their daughter to get the judicial bypass required for the two-parent situation, if I explain myself. I also just quickly wanted to say I have a letter here from the Attorney General who also sees this one provision in the bill pertaining to public funding as a direct challenge to the State Supreme Court Gomez decision. And for those of you who have been following the abortion issue here in Minnesota, the Gomez decision of the State Supreme Court of 10 years ago is a very, very big decision for both sides of the abortion debate. It does, in essence, give a state constitutional right of privacy that extends to reproductive rights for Minnesota men and women. So we, of course, at Planned Parenthood know the MCCL is intent on overturning the Gomez decision, either through a constitutional amendment, which they have offered here in the past, or by changing the composition of the state Supreme Court. And I'll just end with that, with this. I don't think any of us really want to see our judicial, our state judicial elections become as politicized on the abortion issue as legislative races have been. And we saw in the last election a couple of Hennepin County district races that were being run around one's position on abortion. And for the first time ever in my 20 years lobbying for Planned Parenthood at the MCCL rally this past January, there was a reference to the election of pro-abortion State Supreme Court Justice Paul Anderson, which to me, I saw that as a real signal that organizations want to find out more where our individual judges stand on the issue, and I suppose mean to elect them out of office. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could sort of follow up with a comment. All of you as legislative candidates at one point.
Make it short. You've had your time. We're running out of time. I'm going to reach members on that note, and I will go back to you, Professor Schultz. It's been the custom that we have this room. Committees have their room up to 15 minutes after their scheduled time, which has now elapsed about 3 minutes ago.
Sure.
Before we conclude, number one, Representative Zellers is back, and he has his witnesses that were not here at the time of his hearing. I would, as a courtesy, make that announcement. They are here. If anyone has any questions when this hearing is over. Number two, Mr. Chairman? Number two, just a minute, I'm talking. Number two, we're going to go to your statement, closing statement, Professor Schultz, which will be a 30-second one.
Yep.
Then, Representative Broad, you can take the table. We'll take a few questions, but at 12:14, we're going to, the chair will return this to the committee, and we will vote. So having said that, Professor Schultz, you have 30 seconds.
No problem. As legislative candidates, all of you know that sometimes fidelity to the truth in campaigns is one of the first casualties. And one of the concerns here is the fact that whether the statistics are gathered at the individual judicial stage, I think we will find that the gathering of these types of statistics is going to be used against judges and to further politicize judicial campaigns and to further question the autonomy and independence of the courts. Thank you.
Ms. Perpich, 30 seconds and then close.
Chairman Smith, I was going to thank you. You've given us more time than the preceding two committees on the most wide-sweeping anti-abortion bill that's been in this legislature for 10 years.
Ms. Perpich, I appreciate your last comment. I sincerely do. We have a ton of bills that we've looked at already, a ton we have yet to look at. And while I limit testimony, I think and I hope I fairly limit everybody's testimony to an equal time. Now, thank you very much for coming. Representative Broad, take the table. We'll have a few minutes for questions if there are any at this time. Anyone with questions or statements at this time? First, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank
then
you,
Kamar, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, the line of questioning that I was attempting to kind of do earlier is this requirement for a hospital or this agreement with a doctor. If you only have one hospital in the area and perhaps it's a religiously affiliated hospital, that would set the stage then for the entire area, everything 20 miles around in any direction. Could not have an abortion clinic, is that correct?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know that it could be stated necessarily that just because a hospital has a religious affiliation that they would deny care to a woman who has had an abortion. I don't think that's probably a fair assessment.
Mr. Chairman, the line of questioning that I had before was I asked if they would be denied care, and the statement was that they have to have an agreement first in order to be providing it. So if, therefore, the hospital denies giving any agreement, therefore you deny the right for anyone to be performing them within
that circumference of 20 miles in any direction around this particular hospital, if they so choose, because of their religious beliefs, not to permit those or to permit agreements. And so, again, getting back to the map, I'd really like to see where on a map this impacts, because what I suspect, based on what I read, is this impacts rural women and poor women. And those are it.
Okay. Representative Amar, did
Johnson.
Representative Johnson, you're on.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually had a whole bunch of questions, but I'm not going to ask them.
Our time is running
out. I understand. I'm going to make one short point that I thought was really important regarding the professor's commentary when he was talking about the judicial bypass piece. He several times referred to an attempt to create an obstacle or make it more difficult for women to get an abortion. Number one, this piece has nothing to do with women. It has to do with girls. And I think that, and in some cases, if I remember the testimony from last year, little girls. And to suggest that the government, that the legislature has an interest in providing parents with information when their girls and sometimes little girls want to have an abortion, but now to determine whether that's being totally ignored by the courts is not legitimate or unconstitutional, I think is a tremendous stretch.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion, if I may.
What is it?
I would like
Let's see if you may or may not.
I would like to move that we strike Section 2, Subdivision 4 and 5, and Section 4 of the bill.
It's, I think, a valid motion. We are short on time, so give your explanation if you have one, and we'll just put it to the vote.
Chair, I think the explanation was clearly made by Professor Schultz.
Okay. Discussion on that, Representative Pamar's motion for deletion. Representative Cornish.
This is Chair, I'd just like a roll call vote.
Roll call vote. Keep it brief. Anything further? Is the motion? Does anyone have a question on the motion? If not, on the motion.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Restate the motion. So I know what sections are dealing with.
One of staff up here, please restate the motion. Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I believe the motion is to amend House File 3258 to delete page 3, lines 8 through 36. Page 4, delete lines 1 through 18. And to delete section 4.
Is that the motion? Representative Paymar.
To delete section 2, subdivision 4 and 5, and section 4.
Okay, that is our motion. Representative Broad, your comment.
Mr. Chairman, I would urge members to vote against that motion. I do not view it as a friendly amendment.
On the motion, clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
No.
Representative Eastland?
No.
Cornish?
No.
Ellison?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Meslow?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Newman?
No.
Paymar?
Yes.
Soderstrom?
No.
Motion fails on an 8-4 vote. The amendment is not adopted. We are back on the bill. House File 3258. Representative Ellison, comment. We're bearing down on our vote.
And I'm going to be quick, Mr. Chair. All I want to say is these bills, they are highly contentious, and we're all going to vote however we're going to vote. No problem with that. I'm happy to stand on my position. But I look forward to the day, Mr. Chair, when we can get together on preventing abortions, which is where I think we should be spending most of our time. But that's going to cost money. That means child care. That means prenatal care. That means destigmatizing girls who get pregnant. That means male responsibility. And that's where we need to be focusing our time. I'm sorry that we're here, but I hope one day to get to prevention of abortions. Thank you.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Soderstrom.
I'd like to make this. Are we going to vote? No, I'd like a roll call vote.
Okay. Roll call has been requested on the motion to
pass the bill and recommend that it pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Policy, and Finance. All right, that's the motion before us. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Yes.
Representative Eastland?
Yes.
Cornish?
Yes.
Ellison?
No.
Hillstrom?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Nestle?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Newman?
Yes.
Tamar?
No.
Soudersham?
Yes.
The you can count Representative Paymar on a motion. On the motion, did pass 8-4 for against the bill has been recommended to pass. Will be moved along. Representative Broad and all the witnesses here today, thank you for your courtesy. Except as otherwise noted on the record in some instances of the testimony. Thank you. Just as another note, again, next week we will be taking back up the immigration bill on Wednesday evening. I asked your cooperation. We've got 5 days to work. If we're going to do any work on it by 2 o'clock Wednesday, if there are amendments, Tuesday at 2 o'clock is deadline for amendments. The chair may not be too inclined to take any amendments if we don't have them by 2 o'clock on Tuesday. There's nothing further. Today, this meeting is adjourned.